Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I started to write this song about you. And then I decided that I would write it all about love.
Kid from Sacramento and Wrong Side of the Bridge in Tulsa, grows up to love New York and to teach at Harvard and Princeton, and to be so enthralled by the philosopher Wittgenstein in college that he never makes it to the Al Green concert he's supposed to attend that night. There's Al Green.
He sounds so good.
And that's enough of an introduction to the fact that Cornel West, at the age of 56, has written a memoir. It's called Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Brother West, thanks for coming on to talk about your life.
I am blessed to be here, and I want to salute you, my brother, for the magnificent contribution you make in terms of high-quality dialogue in the Big Apple.
Nice of you. Let's start with your christening. Your mother said christenings are not usually memorable, but yours at the Paradise Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was different. What happened?
Yeah, it was amazing. Of course, I was just a few weeks old, but Mom tells me that she and Dad went to the front of the church for ordinary christening, and lo and behold, the Holy Ghost hit, and they shouted for 15, 20, 30 minutes saying, this child has a special purpose in the world. In fact, of course, in biblical context, one of anointment, and I didn't know about this myself, and I said to myself, well, what kind of anointment? Because as you know, I was a young gangster for so long when I was growing up, a little Ronnie rather than Cornell. But that christening is a fascinating moment.
Ronnie. People called you Ronnie.
Yeah, little Ronnie. Little Ronnie. Absolutely.
And you're so people were dancing in the aisles and stuff that, you know, usually you don't find at a christening. And your mom took it to mean something.
Well, she thought that I had a special purpose in life. She thought that, you know, my song, Jesus, be a fence all around me, I would have a protection as long as I just bore witness to truth and justice.
And you were an unusual kid. You write that you were a serious child who struggled with the most profound paradox of all, certain death in the face of joyous life. I mean, how early in life did you start thinking about that?
I started having death shudders when I was five of what it really meant to experience non-existence, which, of course, is already a contradiction. No experience per se in the human sense of non-existence, but just to be preoccupied, reflect, wrestle, ponder, grapple with non-existence, grapple with what it means to be radically contingent, what it means to be in a fleeting world of bodies, and each the dates, concepts having a time, or bodies having a time, a beginning and an end, and so on.
5 years old?
Yeah, 5 years old.
And you tell a story of how in your preteen years, when you were discovering sexual attraction, that you linked the life force of boy-girl energy in music and dancing to the death force. I mean, this is not your typical dancing kid who makes that kind of a leap.
No, it's true. Because what happened was, given that death shudder, it became connected to those fundamental things that matter, those most precious experiences, memories that one can have.
Affecting your experience of them how?
Mainly just being in the present, being inside of them in such a way that I can embrace all of the various aspects and facets of it, but also note, of course, that it in some sense was fleeting. So that, for example, music became so fundamental, remains fundamental in my life, but also dancing, that for me, music's connected to body, body's connected to rhythms, rhythms connected to funky stylizations of space and time that allows you to revel in a moment, be empowered, and then moving out into the world and then on to, you know, struggles for truth and justice.
So enjoying yourself in the moment, knowing someday you'll be gone, and doing your best for the world.
That's right.
At this moment, knowing that our lives are fleeting.
Absolutely. And we must keep alive traditions of love and traditions of justice that are so very, very fragile in a world in which the dominant cycles are those of violence and hatred and bigotry.
Does the death shudder, as you call it, inform your religious faith now at the age of 56?
Well, what's fascinating is when I nearly died wrestling with cancer, of course, just 8 years ago, the
prostate
death shudder
cancer.
Came, your prostate, that the death shudder came to a close. I'll never forget right before I was being wheeled in by my dear brother, Dr. Peter Scardino's best in the world, my view, And then they checked my temperature. It was 120 over 79. They said, that's normal. Why don't you have high blood pressure? I said, no, I'm willing to accept my fate. I embrace the will of God. If that will is to take me away, I pray for Mom and those who love me as they wrestle with my passing. But I, at that point, it was almost like Billy Budd, you know, in Melville's Corpus. Tremendous serenity, a sense of calmness in the face of death. And when I emerged many, many hours later, I had the same calmness. It's amazing.
Cornel West's new memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Can you tell us that Al Green Wittgenstein story?
Oh, yes, indeed. I tell you, Al Green was my favorite. You know, Let's Stay Together and other such hits. I was on my way to the club, but I had just bought the Tooman Janik book called Wittgenstein's Vienna, a book that means the world to me. And I was on my way out. I began to peruse the text. I started reading. I was so grabbed by the genius of Wittgenstein and his relation to Gustav Mahler and Johannes Brahms and Max Weber and that magnificent condry of towering figures in Vienna at the time. I couldn't put it down. And so it ended up Wittgenstein's performance actually it displaced Al Green's performance that night. But that in some ways describes my life. You know, I got Einstein and Malcolm X. Those are the two pictures at Harvard College in my dorm. And then Wittgenstein and Al Green.
But had you paid for the tickets?
Yes, I had, though.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. So I had to give it up.
The life of the mind competing with the life of the body?
Well, no, because Al Green is mine, too. It's just the rhythmic, mediated with bodily rhythm, but it's mine, too, because his intelligence and imagination work. And, of course, Wittgenstein has a body, too. So but it was just the choice of two different modes of imagination, intelligence, and engagement with the world.
You write that you chose teaching over preaching. Did you seriously consider becoming a preacher?
No, thank God. No, I think it's a sign of divine wisdom. I was never licensed nor ordained. Now, my teaching is a form of ministry in terms of trying to touch souls as well as touch minds, and that's one of the reasons why my style, a lot of people associate with the preacherly style, but that preacherly style has nothing to do with preaching per se. Preaching is the proclamation of a particular kind of good news for Christians, the love of Jesus and the grace of God.
So preaching and teaching are different because teaching accepts more uncertainty.
Teaching is Socratic to the core. Question, question, question. It's prophetic in terms of accenting suffering. It's tragic comic in terms of being in conversation with some of the most profound minds that tend to be dark, the Kafkas and Shakespeare's and Toni Morrison's and Soyinka's that tend to be accenting the underside of who we are.
But you refer to what you call a Socratic spirituality in the book.
Yes.
Are Socrates and your Baptist Christianity compatible?
No. No, no, no. I think in the end you have to choose, but very much like, you know, a lapsed Christian like Samuel Beckett, who I cannot live without, that my Christian faith is not compatible with the radical agnosticism of a Beckett, but Beckett helps me become a better human being because his Socratic questioning pushes me against the wall. And, of course, there's so much compassion in Beckett alongside the agnosticism. Of course, my favorite, Chekhov himself, same way, same agnostic, same profound sense of compassion. But in the end, my Christian faith is not compatible with a Beckett or a Chekhov.
Hey, is teaching at Princeton any different from teaching at Harvard, since you've done plenty of both, even within the Ivy League? Do you find there is a, it's not a political question.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's not about Larry Summers
that's
or anything
right.
like
God
that.
Bless Brother Summers, yeah, that's right.
Do you find there is a Harvard kind of intellectual life and a Princeton kind?
It's a good question. I mean, one, it's just a blessing to teach in both places because they're magnificent places, tremendous intellectual ferment and intellectual intensity that excites me. I think Harvard tends to be a bit more cosmopolitan because of Harvard Square and because of the city environment, the urban context. Princeton tends to be a context where the students work harder. They have more time. It's more idyllic. It's more halcyon. It's farther removed from the city. You can expect more of them because they're working so much harder. But both experiences are just magnificent pedagogical experiences. I'm very blessed, as you know, to be at Princeton, Shirley Tilghman, my dear sister president there. But my years at Harvard, magnificent for the most part.
You taught at the Union Theological Seminary here in New York. When was that?
That was 8 years, beginning in 1977 in the great Reinhold Niebuhr's office. Those years with James Washington and James Forbes and James Cone and, Robert Handy.
And that's an institution with an amazing religious and intellectual tradition.
Yeah. And Ulanoff. No, it's just, I mean, in many ways, Union Seminary is the closest institution that enacts and embodies my identity, because as Christian, as thinker, as lover, as inadequate struggler, Union brings together the life of the mind and the Christian commitment to service. It's just that at a Princeton secular, even though it has Presbyterian origins, of course, but Princeton thoroughly secular, I love being there and I'm blessed to be there. But as an institution, it's radically secular, and therefore I'm part of a conversation with other persons. Union's all about understanding the Christian gospel and late modernity.
What was it like for you living in New York those 8 years?
Oh, magnificent, man. I'm telling you.
Are there things you love and things you hate about this city?
Well, I hate the indifference to the poor. I hate the fact it's just too much social misery in the city. That's true for any city. It could be Bombay. It could be San Francisco. It could be New York. I love Broadway and Stephen Sondheim's musicals, from Into the Woods, The Company, The Follies, The Passion. I love the nightclubs, be it the Manhattans coming over from Jersey City, or the Made Ingredients still going, or spending the time at the Apollo on Wednesday evening, seeing that new talent flow, be it early DJ Hollywood, or Luther Vandross, who I was able to see when he was very, very young. So that it's you can imagine, it's a good side, it's a bad side, it's a light side, it's a night side.
Wow. Race became so central to your work. I mean, you've been talking about everything here, and I think people who know the fullness of your work know that you're into Stephen Sondheim and Mahler and Wittgenstein, all this other stuff. But when most Americans think of Cornel West, they think of that Black Studies professor.
Yeah, indeed.
When does that become liberating, and when does it become limiting to study your own culture so much?
Well, one is that, I mean, it's my roots. It's the very source that sustains me. So when I think about race, I don't think of an abstract discourse on white supremacy. I think of my grandmother, grandfather. I think of Reverend Willie P. Cook. I think of Shiloh Baptist Church. I think of my brother Clifton, my mother Irene, my father Clifton, my son Clifton, my daughter Zaytoun, and so forth. So that, you know, Sly Stone says a family affair begins with the family, spills over into a larger community. So that I believe that R-O-O-T-S, roots are tied to R-O-U-T-E-S, your routes. I begin with my roots and then go to, it could be Vienna, Paris, it could be Ghana, it could be Vietnam, it could be China, it could be Russia. But I don't forget my roots. And so in that sense, I don't mind when they look at Brother West and say, oh, that's that Black professor concerned about Negroes. That's right. I am the Negro who loves Negroes, but my love doesn't stop there. It spills over to indigenous peoples and Jews, Palestinians, Chinese, Japanese, Guatemalans, Ethiopians, and even white brothers and sisters in Appalachia trying to deal with the night side of the American empire.
Wow. Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, the new memoir from Cornel West. Just have a minute left. Give me 30 seconds on how Obama's doing, in your opinion.
I think symbolically is magnificent in terms of his charisma, in terms of his brilliance. I think in terms of substance, profound disappointment. He's got the wrong economic team. He's got the wrong foreign policy team. His democratic rhetoric does not fit well with the technocratic policies, and he needs more spine, more backbone. Draw the line in the sand. Take a stand like Lincoln, like FDR. Don't be a Black version of Bill Clinton, wavering, negotiating, triangulating.
And riff on one other piece of music for us that you mentioned in the book, Going Out the Door. We have the Furious Five coming up right here. Oh, and that's going to start in 10 seconds. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Grandmaster Flash and Furious Five, the message reflecting on the night side of one of the great cities of late modernity, New York City, that tremendous linguistic creativity and virtuosity of those young black folk, often rendered invisible, but yet at the same time becoming visible because their genius and talent is undeniable. Grandmaster Flash, Furious Five, do your thing. We'll never forget you.
Cornel West, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Brother Brian. Stay strong.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.